for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President George H.W. Bush once described debates to Jim Lehrer this way, quote, "Those big time things, it was Tension City." Lehrer has been in Tension City 11 times as a presidential debate moderator. His wife, novelist Kate Lehrer, has been there too, helping him craft questions and prepare. Now, the veteran PBS journalist takes us behind the scenes in his new book titled Tension City. Jim and Kate Lehrer join me for an insider's account of presidential debates. I know many of you are fans of Jim Lehrer and Kate Lehrer and will join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Thank you,
Good
Diane.
Morning, Diane.
Nice to have you
Good
here.
To you.
Good to see you.
Jim Lehrer, why do you compare the experience of moderating a debate to walking down the blade of a knife?
Well, it's a realistic analogy.
Sure
I
is.
I always felt that every time I did one of those, that I was walking down that blade and any little gust of wind or gust of mistake, I could get cut. And so I always, it grows out of the simple fact that so much is at stake, not just for, not for, small for me, but very large for the candidates and for the country. And so the knife works for me as an analogy.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Kate Lehrer, you once said to Jim when he proclaimed how much of a burden this was and how nervous he was. What did you say to him?
I said, if you think you're nervous, think about the poor candidates, which
exactly.
is how it felt. Yeah, because I was nervous enough, just as his wife. And I thought about the candidates' families, and thought they're going through the same thing, only a zillion times worse.
So as each of the candidates gets criticism from on the other side of the television set, you too, Jim Lehrer, as a moderator, are getting lots of criticism.
Absolutely. It goes to the territory. There's no way to do that kind of thing and not subject yourself. In other words, when you make the decision to accept an invitation to moderate a presidential debate, you are accepting all the baggage that goes with it, which is that there are going to be some people who are not going to like anything that you do because of their own, what they bring to it. Some of the criticism is absolutely justified. I mean, there is no way to do. I have done 11 of these and a lot of other kinds of debates. I have yet to moderate the perfect debate in terms of myself being a perfect moderator. There are always little things that are going to slip by, things that you wish you had said, and you think of them 30 minutes after they've said cut and all that sort of stuff. So I'm very well aware. What carries me and haunts me and ignites me is the idea that is am I perceived and am I in fact operating fairly? Fairly,
always.
Not just to the candidates,
yeah.
but fairness to the ideas, to everything that's involved. And as long as somebody's not saying, oh, he's unfair, ah, la, 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 well, they'll still say that. But if I feel myself that I was fair, I can get through that, and I have.
Now, that's not to say that you don't look back and feel you have made mistakes.
Absolutely. I made several mistakes, many mistakes. One time in a debate between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis, I literally missaw the cue. The cues were in red, orange, yellow, and green lights. And George H.W. Bush was giving an answer. He was right in the middle of the answer. And I stopped him and said, time's up. And he looks at me. This is 50, 60 million people watching. And he looks at me and says, no. Hey, the yellow light's on. And, of course, he was absolutely right. And I said, oh, Mr. President, I'm sorry. And go ahead. And he said, I forgot what I was going to say.
In other words, he was
so angry with me.
Of course.
And I don't blame him because it just it killed his rhythm and where he was. And I felt like a fool.
Of course. Kate, were you in the audience at that one?
That one I was not. I'm almost sure I was just not there. And
were you watching it on television?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. And they're horrible when something like that happens.
Oh, my
but,
gosh.
Of course, on something like that, I'm feeling sorry for Jim and thinking, oh, he's going to—he nobody's tougher on Jim than he is on
exactly.
himself.
Exactly. He's going to beat yeah. up on himself for that.
I was pretty sorry for the president, but yeah. I was even sorrier for Jim in that situation.
But the thing that Kate always reminded me that first time and just said it again that is always in my mind is that, let's say, I do foul up badly. Example I gave Bush Dukakis it was a small foul up, but let's say I had done something huge. The worst thing that can happen to me is that I make a fool of myself, and they write a story and they say Jim Lehrer made a fool of himself, and we'll never have him do any of that again. But if a candidate makes a mistake, the candidate, as Kate reminded me then and always, candidate makes a mistake, he or she loses the presidency
exactly.
of the United States.
Exactly.
And the stakes are as high as it can possibly be.
Do you recall the first time you were asked to moderate a debate and what your reaction was and Kate's reaction as well?
I do remember. The call came from Ed Fooey, who was then the executive. He'd been producer, an executive in television network news for years, but he was then the executive producer for the Commission for Presidential Debates.
Right.
And he's the one who called me. And I was stunned.
I didn't expect that.
I did not expect it. I was honored. My first reaction was, oh, my God, I can't believe, you know, little Jimmy Lehrer, they want to do this. And then I thought,
who rides buses?
Yeah, exactly. But then, of course, in the reality, Diane always sets in. Oh, my God, I've got to do it.
Exactly.
And all those things that are involved, it isn't just writing questions. It's all the many, many little pieces of it, and it's scary.
I want to get into the writing of those questions and the way you chart things. But, Kate, do you remember that first time Jim was asked to?
Yes, and it is just as he said. I mean, he is upset about thinking about what he's got to do. I am upset thinking about what he's got to do and feel this need at this point, you know, still almost like a mother. Yes, well, can he get himself together? Can he get his act together to do this?
And go to kindergarten.
And go to kindergarten by himself. You know.
Can you explain the collaboration that goes on between you? Kate, I know that Jim puts so much into it, but then he runs everything by you.
Well, I serve as one thing is just a sounding board out there.
Right.
And I admit I am a pretty good sounding board. And I can pick up the things that he is worried about getting everything in, everything right. And I can take a step backwards because I'm not in the formation of everything as he's putting it together and think, oh, this doesn't quite sound right. This would be better. What if you said it? The tweaking, I'm good to catch all those things that might go by.
There was one point when you were not there at the debate, and Jim, you had put your thoughts together, your three questions, and you called Kate, and what'd she say?
Well, I had a question for George H.W. Bush, a question for Bill Clinton, and a question for Ross Perot. And I thought they were apples questions, all three. You know, fair to each one of them. And I read them to Kate on the phone. She was in Washington. She had been on book tour. And so she couldn't go. I was in East Lansing, Michigan. And I called Kate, and I read the three questions. I said, here are my questions. Boom, boom, boom. And I got, on the other end, absolute silence.
Whoa.
And I thought, oh, my. I've been down this road before. All right. And I said, you know, because I was ready to go. I mean,
yeah.
I had to go to the hall.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, what is it? And in my unjolliest mode. And she said, well, you've got two apples and one orange. And I said, all right, tell me. And, of course, she tells me what they were. And I said, well, great, I got to go. And I got in the car. Fortunately, I got a break because I was in a Secret Service motorcade, and the Secret Service guy took the wrong route, and we ended up being stopped by a train, a freight train.
Oh, my God.
So I got to sit in the back of the car, and I was thinking about what Kate had said.
Yeah.
And I dismissed it then,
yeah.
But I sat in the car, and I read, oh, my God almighty, she's right. And so I quickly had time. I quickly wrote another apple, got to the hall, called Kate, and told her, and she there was no answer. She was out worrying about me.
Jim Lehrer, he's the author of a new book. It's titled Tension City. Kate Lehrer's most recent novel is Confessions of a Bigamist. Jim Lehrer is here in the studio. He has just written his gazillionth book. It's titled Tension City. It's all about his role as moderator of presidential debates so far. And I'm not implying anything. So far, he has moderated 11 of those presidential debates, in preparation for which he is forever talking with, collaborating with, checking out his thoughts, his ideas, his questions with his beloved wife, novelist Kate Lehrer. And we are going to take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Jim Lehrer, how did you do this book? It's rather different from the kinds of books you've been doing recently.
Well, I've been doing, as you know, I've been doing
lots
fiction.
Of
the
novels.
Last 20 books have been fiction.
Yeah.
And this is a whole new wrinkle. I couldn't make it up anymore. I had to be very careful with the facts and all of that. And I came, I just decided to do it for two reasons. I had done 11 of the debates, and I was pretty sure I was not going to do any more. So why not talk about it? And I had that unique experience. Plus, I'd had this privilege of interviewing just about all of the presidential and vice presidential candidates who had participated in these televised debates about their debate experiences. So I thought the combination, this was the time to do it. And it was, I had a lot of organizational problems and all of that, that I was helped a lot by not only Kate, but by my fabulous editor at Random House, Bob Loomis, who, as I say at the end of the book, this book was a mess until Loomis got a hold of it. And one thing about Kate, by the way, just let me say for the record that, yes, she's my wife, but I should have put this in the book, but I've told other people this. If I'm ever asked by somebody who's going to moderate a presidential debate and said, "You got any advice, Jim?" And I say, my number one advice is hire Kate Lara, because as a professional, because her advice, if it was just, you know, "I love you, dear, and let me tell you what I want to, you know, let me help you," it just wouldn't work. I mean, her judgment and her professional attitude toward, yes, it's colored by her caring for me, but it's her professional judgment that matters to me when it comes down to the nitty gritty of these presidential debates. And so I listen to her as a professional, not just as somebody I love and as love that's returned. It isn't all of that, I tell you.
Kate, it's clear that your professional judgment has gone into what finally comes out in these debates. You know, I don't know how someone like you, married to the moderator, can sit back and not be part of what's going through his mind.
I think part of it comes from actually both of our being novelists, because there's a discipline. It doesn't do me any good, for instance, if he's going to read one of my books and just says, "Oh, I like it," you know.
Right.
Or, "It's great," and you don't have much to do. And it actually makes me mad, because I want a real critique. It's not worth it. It's a waste of our times. And I do the same thing with him. I mean, we've had plenty of fights about it. We don't have that many fights over my helping him with debates. But I've been brainwashed. I know what's the most important thing when he gets through with it is that it's a good product, that he has done a great job. So I am looking at it the same way he does. And he has drilled into me, though I'm not a journalist, fairness, fairness, fairness.
Of course.
And that's what I look for, to be sure he's got it. So in the end, he looks good. And that's all, you know, that's what I care about.
That's what makes the difference.
Yeah.
There are some of the presidents and people who've been part of these debates who really enjoy the experience. There are others like George H.W. Bush who had this to say.
"Well, partially I wasn't too good at them. Secondly, there's some of it's contrived, show business. You prompt to get the answers ahead of time. Now, this guy, you got Bernie Shaw on the panel, and here's what he's probably going to ask you. And you got Leslie Stahl over here, and she's known to go for this and that. And you got to remember what Leslie's going to ask and get this answer. Now, that answer is not quite concise enough, so there's a certain artificiality to it, lack of spontaneity to it. And I don't know. I just felt uncomfortable about it."
Jim Lehrer, would you agree that there's certain artificiality, certain lack of spontaneity?
Oh, certainly, certainly. And that has to do with the stakes. The spontaneity can lead to a mistake, and a mistake can lead to a loss. And as I say, make it very clear at the beginning of the book, the conflict on the stage is among those for whom winning is everything. And it is not only everything, it is the only thing. That's the candidate and his or her handlers. On the other hand, There's a moderator, and there's the serious press, and in many respects, the audience, they care. They only want information.
Exactly.
It's a political science exercise. It's an informational exercise. But the candidates they will do anything, and their advisors will advise them. And one of the things they are told. Don't go too far. You know, be careful here. That's a third rail, and they talk, and they avoid saying many direct things that they might say otherwise. But remember, these debates come in the last several weeks before the election, and if a guy makes a mistake, toward the end, there's not enough time to correct it. Early on, you can correct it, but with everybody watching, they're very, very careful, and that's carefulness that leads to the lack of spontaneity.
Now, before we play our next clip, you said you talked to pretty much all the presidential, vice presidential candidates. There were, I think, two or three.
Three.
You didn't talk to.
Yeah. Al Gore was just not interested, and for his own reasons. He was very pleasant about it, apparently, but was not interested in doing it. Ross Perot was not interested in doing it, and I even talked to him in the last couple of years about, you know, talking to him again, talked to him again about talking. He wasn't interested in doing it. He said, no, I just don't have anything to say about it, don't want to talk about it. He never has. And the third was Lloyd Benson. But by the time I got around to talking to him, he was ill.
Yeah.
He'd had a stroke, and he very much wanted to talk about it, but he couldn't. But those are everybody else, the Clinton, all the Bushes, everybody else I talked to.
And it's interesting that Lloyd Benson, in his debate with Dan Quayle for the vice presidential nomination, really produced one of the most memorable exchanges.
It is not just age, it's accomplishments, it's experience. I have far more experience than many others that sought the office of vice president of this country. I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
And, Jim Blair, there is a question as to whether that response had been prepared for earlier.
Oh, yeah, and I was not able to. All I was able to do was to get two very different views of it. Some people say, "Oh, yeah, the Benson people knew that Quayle was going to say that because he said it many times."
Yeah.
And during the prep for the debate, one of Benson's guys said, "Well, you know, this," and they worked on the line. Benson himself. Not to me, because I was not able to interview him, but in other interviews, "Oh, no, no, you just made it up," he said. And the record is a little squishy there as to what actually happened. Because Quayle himself said that he knew it was rehearsed. He felt it. There was no question in his mind it was rehearsed, and they were laying for me. And... But it was, it is a major moment in presidential debates, no question about it.
Another certainly major moment was in the Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960, Howard K. Smith. Did you watch that, Kate?
Yes.
I certainly did.
I did.
And I remember this man, Nixon, who looked so dark, and next to John F. Kennedy, who looked so fresh and bright, and you just looked at the two of them, and it was shocking in some ways.
I agree. In fact, I remember when I watched, I was fully, I was an unformed political Well, I wasn't even a junkie yet. I had no politics one way or the other. I was just going to look and see who had the best arguments. Well, it seemed clear to me that John Kennedy just soared past him. I gather, had I watched it on or listened on radio, Nixon would have
you
been
would
the
have
one.
Had a totally,
yeah, totally different,
different impression.
Totally different.
Why do you think that was, Jim?
Well, I think it set the pattern that exists to this day, that people, just ordinary people, in any kind of conversation or presentation, they speak in two languages. They speak the language of the word and they speak the language of the body. And in presidential debates, it can become huge. And the Kennedy-Nixon example was one. There have been others since then where because here's what happens with a presidential debate. People look at that and they want to take the measure of the candidates. Do I like this person? Can I imagine him or her sitting behind a desk at the Oval Office? What about if there's another Katrina? If there's, you know, in other words, by the time you get to those debates, the issues have been pretty well sorted through.
Sure.
With their lock boxes on Social Security, all that's been resolved. No, you just want to take a measure. And the body language speaks as loudly and as clearly as do the words. And that's
and
why it's important.
Even Nixon himself, as you right, yep, said in his 1962 memoir, I paid too much attention to what I was going to say and too little to how I would look. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to DeKalb, Illinois. Good morning, Dennis. You're on the
yes,
air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm a great fan of Jim Lehrer and of you two. I have a question regarding moderating these political debates and asking important and obvious questions even, and then insisting on getting an answer from candidates who really don't want to answer. My example is the Republican debate on CNN last night. I watched it, and all the candidates ranted and railed against Obamacare and the individual insurance mandate. And then Wolf Blitzer asked Ron Paul whether a 30-year-old man who had chosen not to buy health insurance but who later developed a serious life-threatening medical problem should receive any sort of medical care if that would mean that taxpayers or other patients would wind up picking up the bill. And Ron Paul was at least honest and forthright, and he said no, and said that in the old days churches used to pay for such care. At least he didn't mention paying with chickens like Nevada did last year. And Blitzer then asked Michelle Bachmann the same question. And she began by going on and on about getting rid of Obamacare and it's the first thing she'd do, et cetera, et cetera. And Blitzer tried sort of a couple of times to get her to answer his question, but she wouldn't even address it. And then he just dropped his attempt, what's completely
okay,
to get
so
an answer.
Tell me your question.
Well, my question is, he asked this question of sort of fringe candidates and never posed that question to everyone, especially Romney and Perry, and didn't ask for any show of hands or what they would do or ask, you know, would you deny this care and what's the reason for it?
Okay,
this?
So what
how
is...
do you get how can the press be encouraged to answer such to pose obvious questions such as this and demand real answers from the candidates?
It's tough.
Well, it's almost impossible. Interviewers and moderators are not in the demand business. They're in the asking questions business. And you can ask a question, and you can ask it a second time. You can ask it a third time. Then you have to decide when does it do. I always assume, frankly, to answer your question directly, Dennis, I always assume that the audience is just as smart as I am. I ask a question the first time, the guy didn't answer it. And then I ask the second, and they know it. I don't have to yell, hey, you didn't answer the question. You know, I mean, it's there. It's there to be seen. And you got to move on. You got to do other things. Now, sometimes you move on too soon. Sometimes you move on too late. But that's a fine line call. And I watched that debate last night. I saw what I thought Wolf Blitzer did a marvelous job. That is hard what he was doing last night. And he was basically fared all eight of those people, which is not always the case when you have eight or nine candidates like that. That was tough, tough go. And I'm not saying that he did handle that perfectly, but to go back to my earlier thing to Diane, nobody handles those things perfectly. There's always going to be a loose end and a little thing that could have been done. I think the fact that you told the story, Dennis, means you got the point. I mean, you got the point that they didn't, that she did. You know, in other words, you were a smart member of the audience, and that's why the Wolf Blitzers of this world and the Jimmy Charles Lairs of this world have to count on the audience to bring their own good sense and judgment to it as much as the questioner.
And, Kate, of course, you are always part of the audience in one way or another. How are you feeling as you're sitting there watching the debate?
I am on the whole, as I wait and be sure that Jim is going smoothly. He is going smoothly. And then I start watching and listening to the candidates. I know he will kick in pretty instantly.
Kate Lehrer. Jim Lehrer is the author of his, what is it, Jim?
24th book.
24th book, Tension City.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. And by Carbonite, providing automatic and encrypted online backup solutions for home and small business computers. Learn more at carbonite.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, former FBI agent Ali Soufan talks about his experiences interrogating Islamist terrorists. He got Abu Zubaydah to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11. But then the interrogation was taken over by the CIA and Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded. Soufan's new book is called The Black Banners. Join us.
Back to the phones, this time to Indianapolis. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. My question is about narrative. I was a debater in college, and I've always taken a great interest in the presidential debates. And generally, the narrative, so to speak, that comes out of the debates, I generally agree with. But recently, I went back and watched the 1980 debate, and there was only one in that year between President Carter and candidate Ronald Reagan. And that one really seems odd to me, because when I watched it again after so many years, I thought clearly President Carter dominated the debate. As far as the two big criteria that as a debater we look at, presentation and knowledge, President Carter was really on top of his game, about as good of a performance as I've seen in the debate by a candidate. And I just wondered if, after the debate, were there other factors in 1980? And do you go into that at all in your book about was it really the debate that hurt him, amongst other things, or was it simply the Iran hostage crisis that ended up doing him in? Because from everything I understand, that he was very far behind coming out of the convention that year, but that the gap closed and closed, and the last week or so, it was neck and neck.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I don't have this in the book, but my reading of it at the time, if my recollection is correct, that there was very little that Jimmy Carter could have done to overcome Reagan. Reagan, and I'm not sure the debate played a central role in that outcome, bottom line. In fact, my reading for the book pretty much said that, although I did not go into it in the book, my book. There were so many things going against Carter already that he couldn't overcome it.
But there was that moment in the debate where the man who became President Reagan did seem to top Mr. Carter.
Governor Reagan, again, typically is against such a proposal.
Governor, there you go again. When I opposed Medicare, there was another piece of legislation meeting the same problem before the Congress. I happened to favor the other piece of legislation and thought that it would be better for the senior citizens and provide better care than the one that was finally passed.
And, Jim, it's that line.
Yeah.
There you go again.
And it's a classic example of nobody listened to what he said about Medicare. The issue was Medicare, but it was there you go again. It's become part of the literature of presidential debates. I mean, a good line, rehearsed or otherwise, makes a place, and it stays that way, and it made an impression that night. My only point is, I'm not sure I agree with the questioner from Indianapolis that debate was probably not a deciding factor in terms of the, because Carter did just as well, except for that one line. But that got a lot of attention. That was what people were talking about when the debate was over.
The very first presidential debate you moderated was between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis. First, what do you remember about it? And then, Kate, I want to ask what you remember about it.
The thing I remembered most about that debate is what I remember about every debate since then, is just how fast it all is. You say you think you got 90 minutes, and you've got all these things to do, and you say good evening from the Wawa, the this and this and this, and let's go. And then before you know it, it's 90 minutes, and they're saying 2 minutes, and it is such a concentrated thing. I have managed to, I use the term in the book, I mean, just to absolutely zone out, and I mean the world could be coming to an end right before my very eyes. And I don't see it. I'm paying attention. I'm doing what I'm there to do, and because all you have to do is I, for instance, in another debate I did with Kerry and John Kerry and George W. Bush, I lost sight in my mind. I lost track of whether it was a response or a first question, and I had to make. I had all my notes and all my charts, and I panicked because I couldn't, and I just had to guess. And I lost my attention, and I got away with it. I guessed right, and I got away with it.
And Kate, what was it like for you?
Well, it's that same thing. I am pretty much being sure he's being fair and everybody gets the right time. And then, of course, Of course, the Kitty Dukakis
is, and we're about to hear that.
The first question goes to Governor Dukakis. You have 2 minutes to respond. Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why we have had the biggest drop in crime of any industrial state in America, why we have the lowest murder rate of any industrial state in America.
And Kate, what was your reaction?
Well, my reaction was, Jim wasn't involved in that debate, but that's Bernie Shaw's debate set, but and question, I should say. But in fact, I was watching that at home, and I'm sure mine was just like yours. I couldn't believe he had done it.
Couldn't believe it.
Just couldn't believe it. It was shocking.
Do you think that was an unfair question, Jim?
You know, I don't think it was an unfair question. I think there's a lot of people who do think so. I think that the problem was it was the mention of Kitty Dukakis as a person. And but really, in retrospect, it was the answer that did the harm to Michael Dukakis. It wasn't the question so much. If it's a double-edged sword when you ask a, quote, gotcha-type question. And that was a gotcha question. And Bernie Shaw, I've talked to Bernie Shaw about this. I talked to him about in writing this book. I mean, he has no second thoughts about this at all.
None.
None at all. And as he said in the book, I don't have any first thoughts about it. I thought it was legit based on what
a lot of people didn't want him to ask that question.
I know. Well, there were three panelists on that in that debate: Margaret Warner and Ann Compton and Andrea Mitchell, and they tried to talk him out of it. And it was portrayed as the women against Bernie. Because they didn't want him. They didn't want him.
But
to
there
ask
was
the question.
There was a whole backstory to that Bernie Shaw had been assured that nobody would leak that question.
That's right.
And it got leaked.
Well, he was afraid it got leaked, and there was no evidence afterward that the campaign, in other words, that the book, because I say this in the book, there's no evidence that the Dukakis campaign knew this was going to be asked. And the best evidence is if he had known it was going to be asked, why in the world would he have answered it that way?
Well,
I mean, he would have prepared it. Because as George H.W. Bush said, my goodness, if he'd been asked that question, he would have said, I would have tried to find a guy and strangle him myself. You know, I mean, it was the kind of dry answer with no emotion is what hurt Michael Dukakis more than the question itself.
All right. To San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Claudia.
Good morning, Diane. And I want to thank you and Mr. Lehrer for wonderful programming, which is becoming more and more rare nowadays. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
My question is in regards to your preparation, Mr. Lehrer, for your debates. So as I understand it, you are fully in charge of choosing those questions. And do you have to submit those somewhere in advance to your network? And can you change them completely on the spot? And my other questions would be, is in your debates or any other presidential live televised debates that you are aware of, do candidates ever know any of those questions in advance?
I'm really glad you asked that. All of the questions that are asked by moderators, including mine, of course, are the sole product of the moderator. They're not cleared with anybody. And yes, you can change any, whatever. Nobody knows what the questions are, so clearly you could change them, which I have done many, many times in the course of a debate, decided to ask something different than I had planned to ask based on an answer that had come. And so it is very important that, it's very important that a moderator understand that a leak of a question could be devastating. And so I always maintained absolute security. I mean, 5 days before every debate that I was moderating, I quit talking about it even to members of the NewsHour staff and talked only to Kate about it. And because if you start talking to somebody, well, hey, is Larry going to ask such and such and such and such? Well, I don't know. And before you know it, it gets back. And keeping in mind the intensity and the stakes, it would be a godsend to a particular candidate to find out in advance that Billy Bob was going to ask a certain question. And so you got to make sure that does not happen.
Well, the other thing you got to make sure that does not happen is that the technical part doesn't go down. But in fact, on one occasion, the audio, and another occasion, the video, your opening statement, everything is blocked off.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you do?
Boy, it requires the utmost of discipline not to start yelling at somebody
to
on the air.
To stand up and say, what is the matter with you guys?
Uncover the teleprompter, for God's sake. In each case, that's why you're paid the big bucks. No, you're not paid any money at all to do that. But
yeah,
but
that's
why
you
if you panic for something like that, then you shouldn't be a moderator.
Absolutely.
That's why they want people who do that kind of thing to do that sort of work, because I've been doing live television for many, many years, and something always goes wrong. And if you go there, sit down to moderate a presidential debate and assume nothing's going to go wrong, you're the wrong person to be sitting there. You have to assume things are going to go wrong. And when they didn't put the opening up for the debate, the Obama McCain debate, I had that so cleanly in my head.
Did you also have
I was
it
about,
on
I had
paper?
The script. I had the script. But and I was ready to look down, but I was able to go until suddenly somebody realized that they needed to open it up. But you could never tell that I was I didn't have that. But that's no big deal. That's what I do. That's what you do for a living.
I was going to say that a lot of people, though, that watch the rehearsal, you know, I'd hear the whispering, well, why does he have to have that up on a teleprompter, where he is and what the debate is? And I thought, don't you understand? These are the things that he shouldn't be thinking about. And if you've got them there, then that's just one less thing. Why memorize those little things that can, you know, when you've got the big things just before you?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Burlington, North Carolina. Good morning, Reed.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you. You always give us the best of the best.
Oh, thanks.
I was wondering if Mr. Lehrer, and I'll put this in context, I remember the Democratic primary debate of 2008, and remember thinking to myself, looking at the people on the dais there, that, you know, while I have my preferences, I wouldn't be scared or uncomfortable with any of these people as President of the United States. I'm wondering if Mr. Lehrer, in any of the 11 debates that he's moderated, has sat down and as a citizen thought to himself, all these people could do the job, or conversely, man, I don't think any of these people are
Oh, Reed, let me tell you the truth here. It actually goes back to Kate's point in a different context. I'm so concentrated on what I'm there to do that things like that, those kinds of thoughts, my mind is not large enough to bring in any outside thing like that. I just don't allow myself to make those kinds of judgments. Because once you sit there thinking, well, is this guy going to really be a good president, or blah, 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 forget it. That's not what I'm there to do. I'm there to make sure that people get the information so they can decide that those kinds of things. And I don't want to clutter up my thought processes with that.
All right. And to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I was calling because this morning I saw a clip on Hubsky.com of Newt Gingrich kind of lashing out at a moderator. It was John Harris of Politico. I don't know if you saw that, Mr. Lehrer, but yes. He sort of scolded the moderator for trying to get the GOP candidates to fight amongst themselves. I'm wondering if when moderating, if you've ever had one of the people on stage sort of scold you for the way you were conducting yourself, and if so, how you dealt with it?
Nobody has ever scolded me on the stage for moderating, but keep in mind on the Gingrich thing, Gingrich has made a career out of criticizing the press, and he always gets particularly in Republican audiences, he always gets gets some applause. I think that's what that was about. But it's never happened to me. Kate, do you remember? I don't remember anybody.
Don't. The only candidate. One would be George H.W. Bush saying,
Hey, man, I got some more time.
Yeah, I still have some time. Jim, a last question for both you and Kate. Is there a different format that you think might work better for the American people?
I think the format that was used in the first Obama-McCain debate is probably the best, where you ask a question and then you have a discussion for 9-10 minutes about that question, and then you move on. It's open. It's not restrictive in terms of 30 seconds, 1 minute, whatever. I think you need to have some guidelines, but the fewer the better, but you have to have some.
Kate, what do you think?
I absolutely agree.
And that debate you felt gave people the most that they could
the opportunity to the candidates to do what they wanted to do.
Jim Lehrer, we have decided that he's actually written 23 books, the latest of which is titled Tension City. His wife, novelist Kate Lehrer, Confessions of a Bigamist, is her most recent novel. Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.